I am extremely grateful to be with all of you this evening in this great historical city of Aurangabad. My special gratitude to Honorable Chief Justice Chappal Gaonkar, to our beloved host Rishi Bagla, to our Member of Parliament, Chandrakant Kere, and to Mareshwar Save, and to all of you. I was asked to speak something about this book that was written, The Journey Home. When my dear friend Bhakti Tirtha Swami was on his deathbed, he made me promise that I would write this book. It's something that for many decades people asked me to do, but I was extremely reluctant. I was thinking, isn't it an act of arrogance to write a whole book about me? And if I tell the truth, who would believe it? But I made my promise. And actually, after I promised him, I was actually planning to convince him to allow me to withdraw that promise. But before I could do that, he passed from the world. So in his honor and memory, I've written this memoir, which is the story of a young teenager born and raised in the affluence of America, who saw serious problems. Wealth, prestige, power cannot, will not, and never will in itself bring real happiness or fulfillment in life. I saw it all around me and saw so much arrogance, greed, envy, cruelty. I heard the words of Mahatma Gandhi, "Be the change you want to see in the world." But how to do that? I became very politically involved and was demonstrating against injustices as part of what was called the counterculture. But I saw all around me and in myself the same hypocrisy that we were fighting against in ourselves, just with a different dress and a different language. And I came to the conclusion, unless there's a transformation within ourselves, we could never be instruments of real change in this world. And little by little, I came to the conviction that that change is spiritual. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita, which later on I discovered, which seemed to be the very root cause of the problem and the true solution. Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani gabihastinu sunichaiva svapakecha panditasamadarshana. What is real knowledge? What is true wisdom? I knew people who graduated from Harvard and MIT and Stanford and Princeton and Yale, Oxford. But what is true knowledge according to the Gita? One who sees every living being with equal vision. Whether one is white or red or brown or yellow, whether one is from the east or west, male or female, whatever one's caste, whatever one's religion, even whatever one's species. One who sees a Brahmin, an elephant, a cow, a farmer, a dog. Wherever there's life, there is the sacred presence of a part of God. Life is sacred. Aham bija pratapita. Every great religion describes the absolute truth or God as the supreme father or the supreme mother of all living beings. That means we are all brothers and sisters. But until we find that personal connection of our own atma or soul with the divine source, with Krishna or God, how can we ever appreciate our real relationship with others? This was the conclusion I came to as a teenage boy living in America. I may not have ever heard the name Krishna, but I understood that I have to find that God within myself to actually learn to be truly compassionate to the souls of others. I began to study deeper than ever Judaism, my own religion that I was born into. But I saw so much hatred, sectarian, and violence between it, religion. Either I have to reject it all, or I have to go deep down to find the essence within it. I began to study Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism and Jainism and Sikhism and Zoroastrianism. I wanted to find, what is it common? What is the essence? And then I decided, it's one thing reading the books, but I want to experience it. So I went on a quest for meaning and fulfillment. And as was said, the first day actually that I was in Europe with my friend Gary, our sponsor was robbed and went back, and we were left with nothing. So we were hitchhiking. And at one time, as I was alone in Afghanistan, I was sitting on the ground in a little tea stall. There were no tables and chairs, just people squatting on the earth, about five or six of us. And this boy came in. He was blind. His eyes were uncovered, and they were grossly disfigured. He was wearing rags. He was emaciated due to hunger. And he had a little wooden branch with a can at the end and a wire nailed across it that was a little instrument. And he stood there. He was about 15 or 16 years old, and he played. Bong, 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 bong. And sang beautiful spiritual prayers. His face lit up that whole little shack. He sang for almost an hour. I was spellbound. I was thinking, this is the happiest person I've ever seen in my life. This was culture shock. Because everything I had ever been taught in my life was, if you have good health, if you have physical beauty, if you have wealth, if you have prestige, if you have good education, you will be happy. And here was a boy who had no education. He was in total poverty. He was sickly. He was hungry. But he was happier than anyone I had ever seen because he was singing of his love for God. It was one of the transformations that took place on this journey. I'll share with you a couple of them. When I entered India, I went to the Himalayas. And just close to Rishikesh, I found a totally secluded place where I sat on the Ganga and meditated and prayed. Hours passed. Suddenly, a holy man came out of the forest and was walking toward me. He had long beard, long white hair. His robes were flowing in the Ganga breeze. He walked up to me. He was carrying something. He said, "You do not know me, but I know you. I've been watching you. Now, take off your Western clothes and offer them to the Ganga. And I will give you the robes of a sadhu." I asked, "What is a sadhu?" He said, "It is a person who has no home, who wanders the world seeking the truth." So that kind of sounded like what I was trying to do. I only had one set of clothes, because in Afghanistan and Turkey, where I was sometimes being chased for my life, I didn't have time to pick up my little bags. So all I had was what I was wearing. And it's incredible. You don't know how much you really identify and attach to something until you have to give it up. I never had a thought that I was attached to my clothes, but because they were the only ones I had for several months, when it was time to put them in the Ganges, it was my identity, my pants, my shirt. But it seemed that this person was mystically giving me some sort of blessing, some sort of rite of passage to a higher state in my spiritual search. I took off my shirt and threw it in Ganga. And I took off my pants and threw it in Ganga. And I stood there. And the sadhu looked at me and said, "You must throw your underpants in the Ganga." At that point, I realized this was becoming serious surrender. So he gave me a piece of cloth and told me to wrap it around myself, and then I, and he gave me a kopan, a loincloth, and one piece of cloth to cover my bottom part and one to cover my top, the same that I'm wearing now, different color, it was white. And then he said one more thing. He said, "The river Ganges will be your mother. This will be revealed to you in time." He turned around and walked away. and I never saw him again. But I found a rock in the middle of the Ganga that I decided to sit and meditate and pray upon from sunrise to sunset every day. And the Lord revealed to me a nice little cave in the jungle where I would sleep at night. In the Bible it is said, seek and ye shall find. Knock, and the door opens. This is a universal truth. When we are seeking truth, it's incredible how even in the most common situations that we see, there can be life-changing knowledge that is transmitted. I was just looking at Ganga. I remember one day I was thinking, as she was flowing, everything is changing if you look at the surface of the river. The waves, they're swirling and they're twirling and they're flowing and they're going up and they're going down. It's a beautiful work of art. But it's never the same. And I was thinking how this is the way life is. Everything is constantly changing. We cannot hold on to anything. We cannot even hold on to a single moment. And ultimately, by the power of time, everything is taken from us. Like the surface of the Ganga. But if we go deeper in life, there is a current of truth that is constant, that can never be taken away. And as long as we're clinging to this ever-changing surface of superficial happiness, then we're constantly being thrown from here and there emotionally. But if we go deep into life and connect with that constant current of truth that's within all of us, then there can be deep fulfillment. One day when I was sitting on the bank of the Ganges, I saw a hawk. He had wide wings, brown, orange, white, and he was circling lower and lower and lower till he was only a few meters above my head. He had a sharp beak, sharp claws. And his yellow eyes were gazing. It looked like he was looking at me. Suddenly, the hawk dove headfirst right into the river. And in the water, there was a skirmish. There was all sorts of splashing. And then the hawk came out with a fish about 1 foot long, helplessly flapping around in his claws. It was only a few meters from me. I looked in the eyes of that little fish. He looked totally shocked and bewildered. And I was thinking at that time, as the fish was being escorted by the hawk into the forest, are we not all like that little fish? The fish was just going about his day like any other day, swimming upstream, downstream, across stream, looking for food, playing with family members and friends. And suddenly, at the least expected moment, the hawk of fate ripped him out of the river. And similarly, we have all seen it. We've all experienced it. We just go about our daily lives, but we don't know when that hawk of faith is going to rip us out of our current complacent condition. What is really important in life? And then I was thinking, if that fish was swimming deeper, the hawk could not touch it. And similarly, if we go deeper into our own spiritual identity, into our own relationship with God, then the ever-changing situations of this world will not really affect us. We could maintain our character, our integrity, and ultimately our compassion and our love, whatever may happen. As the Ganga was flowing, I was seeing how she was, nothing could stop her journey to the sea. There were mountains she was flowing around, big rocks, fallen trees. In the same way, if we have determination, nothing could stop us, no obstacle from reaching the sea of our true aspiration in life. Later on, I learned the confirmation of this from the Bhagavad Gita, that if we want to really be successful in anything we want, especially on the spiritual path, there must be determination. Obstacles are there to make us strong if we see the opportunity. During that month, I sat on that rock from sunrise to sunset, and on my way to the cave, one little old man who sold some vegetables would give me a carrot. And my diet for that month essentially was a lot of Ganga water and a carrot in a day. Somebody gave me a rupee, and I kept that rupee, thinking at the end of the month, I'm going to eat something nice. So when the month ended, I went near the Chotiwala restaurant, and I remember seeing there was a peanut seller, Peanutwala, and I always liked peanuts. So in America, at that time, there was about 7 rupees to a dollar. You'd get about a bag about this big of peanuts where I was from. So I gave him a rupee. They were those kind of peanuts in the shells that were being roasted in sand over a fire with a wok. He started patching together newspapers and made a bag this big and filled it with peanuts. So I was so happy, and I was carrying it back to my cave through the forest, and a big brown monkey happened to see me and showed his teeth, and he jumped right toward me screaming and grabbed all the peanuts and kicked me in the chest. And a few peanuts fell on the ground, so I was thinking at least something's there. Then 2 or 3 little baby monkeys came and picked them up and ran away. My stomach was growling, and I was thinking, what am I supposed to learn from this? And I was thinking that compared to the nourishment and the fulfillment that I was getting through my prayers and my meditation, all of the pleasures of this world are no more significant than a peanut. People lie, they cry, they die for these peanuts. But they do not know at any moment the monkey of another person's greed, the monkey of death, is going to snatch away all our peanuts. This monkey became one of my gurus, one of my teachers. How important it is, my spiritual life. I traveled in Himalayas and met many different rishis and yogis, and gurus, teachers, lamas. At one point, I came to a place while I was traveling north in the Himalayan jungles where I was surrounded by people who were suffering worse than I ever saw suffering before. They had no fingers, many of them, their noses were gone. They were shriveled, deformed, homeless, starving. It was a leprosy colony. When they saw me, a person of light skin, about a dozen of them made a tight circle around me and started screaming in my face, "Bakshish, bakshish," with desperate eyes. I didn't have any money. I didn't have anything except what I was wearing. I wanted to give them something, but there was nothing. But they didn't believe me. They squeezed closer and closer and closer with desperation, crying out, "Bakshish, bakshish." They wouldn't let me go. They were putting their hands in my face. They were spitting on me as they were screaming. This was a culture shock from a boy from the suburbs of Chicago. Will I get leprosy like them? I was in turmoil. And finally, after they searched every inch of me and saw that I actually had nothing, they let me go. And as I walked, I saw to my left a very old leper woman. She was laying on her side. No fingers, no nose, hardly any hair, no teeth. Dressed in rags. And she somehow or other leaned up and looked at me. She looked at me with motherly compassion. It was as if she was speaking through her eyes how much she felt the pain that I just went through when her people harassed me. And then she offered her pranams. And when she saw how deeply moved I was by her compassion, she put her fingerless hand out to offer me a blessing. At that moment, I became so affected by the tender motherly heart of this leper woman that I ran up to her, fell on my knees, and put my head under her hand. And as she rubbed the top of my head in Hindi, she repeated again and again, "May God bless you, my child. May God bless you, my child." I looked up at her and I saw such joy in her face. The joy of giving. The joy of a mother who perhaps decades she wanted to bless a child, but had no child to bless. And somehow God brought me there to fulfill that desire in her heart. This will be difficult for you perhaps to understand. But as a teenager living in America, I was seeing the movies of Hollywood and seeing all the beautiful ladies dressed to attract the opposite sex. That's what America very much is. But when I looked up at this old dying leper woman's face, I was thinking, she is the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my life. What is beauty? Her beauty was her will to love, was her compassion. After I left her, I went to sit on the banks of the river and I was meditating on what am I supposed to learn from this? That what's really valuable and precious and beautiful in life is not just the things. It's love. In a cultured society, people use things and love people. But all too much in this world, people use people to get things. She had nothing but this will to love. 40 years later, I went back to that leprosy colony. When I was going to write The Journey Home, I went back there just to get an experience. What was once people just laying in the forest on the ground was now a government, I believe it's run by the government, nice buildings where all the lepers there, they have their rooms, they have their homes. I saw they all were getting fed nicely 3 times a day. I didn't believe I would find that same old leopard woman, although I did look for her, and I didn't find her. But I did remember, before there was any government care, before anyone in the entire world cared anything about her, she cared about me. What is really valuable in life? On my journey, I met one sadhu. His name was Kailash Baba. He was a huge man. He became a sadhu, I think, when he was 12 years old. He looked like he was about 70, although people told me that he was 150 years old. But he had no ashram. He had no disciples. He just wandered in the wilderness of the jungle. And whenever he came across, he invited me to stay with him. So I traveled with him. We slept under trees, we slept in caves, we slept on riverbanks. And he taught me how to live as a sadhu. He taught me what weeds and herbs I could eat and what I couldn't eat. He taught me what herbs and weeds were medicinal when I was sick. He taught me how to use mud as soap and how to use branches of trees as toothbrushes. He taught me how to beg with dignity. He taught me how to live with our neighbors Because in those jungles in those days, there were leopards, there were panthers, a lot of vipers and cobras and scorpions and monkeys and mosquitoes. He taught me that the only way you could survive living with these people is you must honor them without fear. You have to see the Atma, the soul in their hearts, that they are part of God, and you must give them the honor and respect that they deserve. If you think you're better than them, or if you fear them, they will kill you. Now, this was a course that I had to learn immediately because they were there. But you know something? Because Kailash Baba believed that so much, he taught me to love the soul in the cobras, in the wild boars, and respect them. And being with him, I actually could feel that they were my family, that they were my neighbors. The interesting thing is Kailash Baba did not speak a word of English, and I didn't know his language. He taught me all of these most precious subjects that I ever learned in my life just by appointing or by speaking without me even understanding the language or by raising his eyebrows. And I learned that if a teacher really cares about the student and the student really wants to learn, there's no impediment to the transmission of knowledge. After some time, I went on with my journey again. And I'll just say a couple more things. But at one time, I was living in Patna, on the bank of the Ganga, where I had met one Swami named Ram Sevak Swami. And he didn't speak English either. He was a devotee of Lord Ram. Mostly I was with yogis in the Himalayas. He was one of the first bhaktas that I met. And he had a little temple made out of stone with Ram and Sita and Hanuman. Every day, about 4 or 5 old sadhus would come to his little ashram to read from and discuss the Ramayana for 3 hours. It was quite incredible. The experience that they were having as they were just discussing Ram's leelas, sometimes they were laughing, sometimes they were crying, sometimes they looked like they were in such fear and excitement. And I wanted to hear so much what was affecting them so deeply. There was one man about 85 years old. His name was Narayan Prasad. And he spoke fluent English, the only one. And he promised me at the end of their katha, he would tell me everything spoken. So we sat on the bank of the Ganges together. And he told me a story of how little baby Krishna stole butter and how Mother Yashoda chased after him and he ran away and how Mother Yashoda caught him and tied him up with the rope. He told me the whole story in much detail. And the conclusion, he said that the moral of this story is that the Lord is willing to be captured, defeated by the love of his devotee. I said, what else? What else was spoken? He said, that's all we spoke today. I said, it was 3 hours, and this is only a 5-minute story. There must be something else. He said, no, no, that's all we spoke. The second day, they spoke another 3 hours. I asked him, tell me everything. He explained the same story. Krishna stole butter, Mother Yashoda tied him up. I said, there must be something else. He said, no, no, that's all we spoke. The third day, same thing happened. I started to cry. I said, you're a devotee of Ram. Why don't you tell me about Ram? Am I so disqualified? He said, do you really want me to tell you why? I said, yes. He said, the first day you came to the ashram, Ram Sevak Swami told me he had a dream where Ram appeared to him. And Ram said, this little boy who has come, he is a devotee of Krishna. And you shouldn't tell him about anything except Krishna. So my guru told me, he said, I can only tell you about Krishna. But I'm a devotee of Ram. I don't know stories about Krishna. The only story I know well is how he stole butter, because my mother used to tell me this story. He said, but Ram Sevak Swami told me that you will not believe me if I tell you this. I said, you're right, I don't believe you. But anyways, some months later, I was traveling back to the Himalayas, and I was trapped in a place called Mathura, which happens to be the birthplace of Krishna. And I got typhoid fever. I couldn't leave that place. And by the time I got better, I fell in love with Krishna, living on the bank of the Yamuna River in Vrindavan. The concept of bhakti, the awakening of love within the heart, to me was the very essence and conclusion of all the great religions of the world. And the concept of Krishna to me was so powerful, because God is not just the almighty creator, maintainer, destroyer, punisher, and rewarder, but is all beautiful, all loving, supremely sweet, and could be experienced directly through living in a spirit of compassion and devotion and chanting the holy names. It was there in Vrindavan that I met my Gurudev, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, for a second time. And it's there where I felt in my heart of hearts, there's no greater purpose in my life than to share this great gift. According to my tiny little capacity with the world. This great land of India gave so much to me. Your culture, your traditions, your wisdom, like nothing I ever experienced anywhere in the world. And I feel that I have a great debt to the land and people of India. And in my own small way, I am trying to reciprocate with that debt. And it is for that reason I am here with you in Aurangabad today. Thank you very much.